Samaveta Bhakti Vrindaki Jaya Gaura Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. All Shubhadaya Krishna Sayaka. Srimati Bhakti Nata Swami Chinami and Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pachani Visayasa Samaya Vaswati Swami. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Prajapada Paman Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Stam Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ravanatam Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Kalijina Saita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Nam Sahagana Lavita Sri Vishakam Vitam Stam. So yesterday we went to the University of Hawaii, where there was a meeting of professors to talk about how we could achieve world peace. And we're listening to all different people talk about how we can become more peaceful internally and how we can have peace in the world. And I was thinking that most people, if you ask them, if we could stop all war, would anybody here want to have war? No? Anybody who would like to stop war? That'd be a good thing. What about just kind of the little wars that go on in our life? You know, the wars between family members, between friends, between co-workers, when people shoot their arrows of harsh words and you feel that kind of churning in your heart. Right? Actually, that example is given that one may say, how can chanting a mantra go to the heart? And the answer is, words go to the heart all the time. Right? If somebody insults you, the words go right to the heart. So we have these little wars in our life. Wouldn't we like to be rid of those? Also, right, to actually have peacefulness and happiness. So I thought that to explore this idea of peace on every level, we look at a verse that one of my godbrothers, Ravindra Sri Prabhu, says is the prayer for world peace. It's from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the fifth canto, chapter 18, text 9. This is one of the prayers that Prahlad Maharaj makes to the Lord in his form of Nrisingadeva. Nrisingadeva is a very interesting form of the Lord. There are so many fictitious accounts of some person who, you know, when they get angry, they manifest some other form. Aren't there like cartoon characters and Superman-type characters like that, right? That as soon as they're angry, they all of a sudden, they get bigger or stronger or something like that. So Krishna also, the Supreme Lord, when he has his different moods, he also manifests different forms. And when he gets really angry, we know he says in the Bhagavad Gita, Paritranaya Sadhanam Vinashaya Sudhuskritam, Dharmastabhastapanataya Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. Whenever the pious are threatened, he appears. So when Prahlad, who's a saint, although he's only a five-year-old boy, he's a saint, when he's being threatened with torture and death, the Lord appears in this very angry mood. And he appears as a partial beast. Right? Sometimes when we get angry, we may feel like we act like a beast. So the Lord actually appears in this form that's half man and half lion, with these huge nails like thunderbolts, right, to destroy the demon. So in this great form of ferocious justice, his great devotee Prahlad Maharaj is saying this prayer. He says, Swastastu Vishvaspa Kala Prasiditam Jayantu Bhutani Shivam Mito Dhya Manascha Bhadram Bhajatada Hoksaje Aveshitam No Matir Apyahotuki. May there be good fortune throughout the universe, and may all envious persons be pacified. May all living entities become calm by practicing bhakti yoga, for by accepting devotional service they will think of each other's welfare. Therefore, let us all engage in the service of the Supreme Transcendence, Lord Sri Krishna, and always remain absorbed in thoughts of Him. Matir means one's consciousness. So I was thinking of what are the causes for the big wars where people actually go out with tanks and guns and bombs and blow other people's bodies to smithereens and knock off their arms and legs. And the little wars in our little families and friends and communities and workplaces, where people try to do that in other less dramatic, hopefully, ways. So what are the causes? Anybody give me some idea? I should actually have a pencil here, because I've written down some, but I'm sure you'll think of some I don't have. the cause of the not only the big wars with the bombs, but the little wars that go on even among us. What are the causes?
Sin.
Sin. All right. What is sin? Can anybody define what sin is?
Breaking of God's laws.
Breaking of God's laws. Okay. Where does that come from?
Being independent.
A desire to be independent. Okay. Others.
Human rights. Violations of human rights.
So wanting justice.
And being treated with humanity.
Hmm?
Being treated with people who want to be treated.
People who want to be treated humanly. With humanity and with justice. Okay?
By contact with material nature, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita.
Karana Guna Sangasya. Can you give me some specifics, though, that happen with contact with material nature?
Well, Krishna says lust arises, even from lust.
Okay, so by contemplating
anger.
Okay, so by contemplating, one gets lust and anger, and then bewilderment. Some more causes of wars: being a little
greed,
definitely greed. It's a big
power,
cause.
Lust.
Power, lust. Some more
pride,
enviousness. Okay.
And of course, all sort of put to a higher power because of the age of Kali.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, the age of Kali is the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. And due to the influence of the age of Kali,
so it's kind of a general influence, yes?
War will cease when we stop killing for food.
Okay, so the meat eating also. Killing animals for food is a cause of
karma.
War. Karma. All right, but what starts that? You could think also, why do people kill animals for food? Then we're looking again at lust and greed. Did you have something you wanted to say?
No, meat eating.
Okay, meat eating. Somebody else. And we're looking again not just at the wars with guns and bombs, but even the little wars between us. Yes.
But, I mean, war, as long as there's man, there's going to be wars. You know? The battle of everyone, angels and demons, the gods and the demons, there's always going to be war.
There's always going to be some war. All right, do we need, yes?
Because we're trying to compete with Krishna for his position in this material world, too. We're all trying to compete with each other for supremacy, so there's fighting.
Okay, so this general competition, which I think has to do also with greed.
Also vanity.
Vanity, vanity.
Vanity and sloth, like laziness, like the need to have other people do our work.
To do, sloth, that we want other people to do our work. Therefore, we want, a lot of wars are fought over wanting followers. And that's also true sometimes in our little wars in the family and among friends. You know, I want you to wash the dishes. No, I want you to wash the dishes. You know, I want you to do this, so that sort of thing goes on. All right, well, I'll go through this, and if you think of some more as we go through. I came up with a list of greed, envy, hatred, vengeance, power, and control. That was my basic list. And I was going to think, and it's a fact that there'll always be
religion.
More
and more has been fought over religion.
That's an interesting point, that people use religion.
The Battle of Kurukshetra was fought because of it.
Well, the Battle of Kurukshetra wasn't fought over religion.
Was it Yadav dynasty and the
But it wasn't fought over religion in the same sense that, say, the fighting is going on in the Middle East over religion, or fighting went on is going on in Belfast.
And the Muslims' war has been going on for 1,000 years.
Well, why don't we stop and look at that for a minute, because I like that point. And religion is often accused as being the cause of war, because a lot of wars are fought under religious banners, although the Battle of Kurukshetra wasn't like that. The Battle of Kurukshetra was not...
Muslims hate the Christians, Christians hate the Muslims.
Yeah, but the Battle of Kurukshetra wasn't a Christian-Muslim or Muslim-Jew or Muslim-Muslim or, you know, kind of, or this Protestant-Catholic kind of war. Battle of Kurukshetra was a little bit different. But let's look at religion being the cause of war. Now, people often fight wars with a kind of flying under a religious flag. If you look at it, I don't remember the exact statistics, but religions being used as a cause of war is actually smaller than other causes. And at least in modern times, the really big wars, let me bring some water, please. The really big wars have not been fought under a religious banner. Like, say, World War I, World War II. Nobody was saying that was a war of one religion against another. The Civil War here in the United States. So the major conflicts, at least in recent human history, you go back for the last few thousand years, were not fought with the excuse of religion. So if we're going to talk about number of people killed, we're going to talk about number of years of the war, and things like that, they were fought for other reasons. And my own observation is that people who fight under religious banners are using religion almost the way others use nationality. So they're not using religion in the sense of, you know, we want everyone to love God, which wouldn't be really effective. I mean, if I said to you, I'd really like you to love God, and if you don't love God, I'm going to cut off your arm. You know, that's not really a good way to engender love. So I would like to suggest that it's probably very rare, if ever, that wars are fought over genuine religion. Thank you, Sergeant. Genuine religion means to love God and to serve Him. They're more fought over things like power in the name of religion. You know, that we want to consolidate our power, and we're doing it instead of under a national banner, we're doing it under a religious banner. And religion like that is more a sense of common identity. Just like, just like people have wars over ethnicities. You know, a particular bodily type is fighting with another particular bodily type. And sometimes for people outside the conflict, the difference seems rather invisible. You know, the Tsutsus and the Zulus, and I don't look at them and I don't see any difference between the Tsutsus and the Zulus. They all look the same to me. But when they're fighting with each other, they see that though there's some difference in ethnicity and some difference of ancestry, and that was true in Bosnia also. You know, some of these places where there's these ethnic conflicts, someone outside of them, you're just like, what's the difference between these two body types? And it also happens between nationalities and between religion. It becomes this us and them. You know, it's so religion, I see when religion is used like that, it's really just another way of group identity. We are all this group, we are all that group. Yeah?
Because when I was in jail, I saw a lot of people, different ethnic groups fighting, and the guys don't have anything, right? But I broke it down to its most simplest form, is that whenever there's a conflict, it all boils down to somebody trying to force their will upon somebody else.
I am so glad I called on you.
Somebody's always trying to force their will on somebody else, and that's where all conflicts come from. Somebody isn't like,
What is your good name?
I'm Prasad Das.
Prasad Das. Thank you, Prasad Das. That was a very profound statement. Actually, it was some time ago when I came to the realization that all suffering, all conflict, and all difficulty is due to one living entity trying to force their will upon another living entity.
All suffering is
But trying to force my will. So I have something prepared, but maybe I should go to that. I wasn't going to talk about that. But you really come to the essence of all of this. The essence of greed, envy, hatred, vengeance, power, and control.
Is somebody forcing their will?
Somebody trying. And it's quite interesting, because if we examine Krishna, we will find that Krishna doesn't do this. Krishna does not force anybody. Krishna sometimes incarcerates people. So if you're in a tree body, you're definitely in prison. It's a pretty effective prison. You know, you can't even move, and you can't express much of your free will. Now, I have talked to gardeners who say that they can tell personality differences among various tomato plants, but that's pretty unusual. So generally, you know, if you've got a bunch of 10 tomato plants, it's pretty hard to tell what the different personalities between them are. They do have different personalities. So Krishna does sometimes take a living entity who really misuses their free will, and he does put them in sometimes real heavy-duty solitary confinement for a while. But he doesn't take away their free will. And if you go even a little bit above plant life, if you even go to insect life, people will tell you who work with these creatures that you can tell the difference. You know, people who keep a bunch of bees and stuff, they can notice that there's this bee. We were once in a shopping center, and my children said, "Can we go to the pet store and see the pets?" That's okay. So it was like a little mini zoo, right? And there was a booklet there about hermit crabs. I picked up and started going through the booklet, and the man was saying that you could tell different personalities among different hermit crabs, even though they're not very advanced in consciousness. He said there was if you put a barrier in the cage, a certain hermit crab would always go over it, one would always push it out of the way, one would always go around it. You know, they had their different ways of dealing with things. So my point is that Krishna doesn't take away the free will of the living entity, that even in lower species of life, it's still manifest to some extent. and Krishna never forces. And Prabhupada says this is the difference between love and rape. And Krishna doesn't, he's not interested in rape, Prabhupada says. It doesn't appeal to him. What is the point of that? That is the point of view of the demons, like Ravana says to Sita, if you don't love me, then I'm going to have you cut into pieces and I'll eat you for breakfast. So what kind of love is that? Right? If I say to you, okay, I'll love you so you won't eat me for breakfast. I'm not loving you. That's not genuine love. So Krishna's not interested in that kind of love. And he's not interested in force. It's just not his thing. Although, like I say, he will restrict people. Krishna's interested in a world of freedom. And in the spiritual world, everyone there is liberated. What's the basic definition of the word liberated? Free. They're free. The residents of the spiritual world, which is all originally us, by the way, they can go wherever they want. Like here, we're restricted, especially here in this island. If I want to go someplace else, you know, I can't just like use some mystic power and jump even to another island. I have to be a pretty good swimmer to get there on my own power. You know, and you want to speak if you want to go to another country. It's gotten so bad now with security that when I come back to America, they harass me. You know, I've got an American passport and they're still, where do you live? What are you doing here? What are you here for? So we're not free to just go wherever we want, or to speak of to other planets. But in the spiritual world, everyone is free to go wherever they want. They can go to other planets. Anyway, they can come to the material world to preach whatever they want to do. And kalpa viksha laksha vitesu, there's desire trees. Whatever you want, you can have. In this world, if we said whatever you want would immediately manifest, it wouldn't be very nice. Right? But there, whatever desires you have, whatever you want to go, whatever form you want to take, whatever relationships you want to have, everything is completely free. There's no force. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said there's only two rules. One is you have to love, and the other is you can't allow, not allowed to envy. And as long as you follow those two rules, you can do whatever you want. You're completely free. So Krishna enjoyment takes place in a world of freedom. And freedom means just like this case. You know, I can throw it up in the air. And the case can't say, stop, I'm getting dizzy. I don't want you to do that. Right? What's one of the main differences between matter and spirit is what? Something that's alive can say, no. Something that's alive can say no. Something that's not alive can't say no. Right? This thing can't say no. I'm pushing it. It can't say no. Don't push me.
You're trying to force your will on the box.
Exactly. So Krishna's pastimes take place between the Lord and living beings who can say no. And everything in the spiritual world is a living being that can say no. The water, the buildings, everything, even things that are apparently material. In the spiritual world, they're all living beings that can say no. In other words, the relationships are all voluntary. They're all on the basis of freedom. There's no sense of compulsion at all. No one feels, I have to. There's no rule books. There's no, you know, nobody's consulting the rule books of moral codes. There's no police force. There's no prisons. You know, there certainly is no war. And there's no little wars and there's no big wars. Everybody's doing things because they want to do them out of freedom. Now, those souls that misuse that, that want to force their will on another living entity, come here. And Krishna, in this world, he manifests his energy as matter. Actually, Prabhupada says, from Krishna's point of view, it's all spiritual. From Krishna's point of view, it's not really matter and spirit. Prabhupada gives the example from the government's point of view, a school and a prison is both government. They're not, it's a government agency. You work for the government, whether you're a prison warden or whether you're a school principal. You're a government worker. So from Krishna's point of view, it's not like that. But where is Maya? Prabhupada says this in Krishna book, in the story of Brahma stealing the boys and calves. Where is illusion? In our own mind. And we see things as separate from Krishna. Krishna doesn't want to be forced, and we have a desire to force. So therefore, Krishna's energy, which is non-different from Krishna, appears to us as something dead that we can force. And we can. I get to say, move over here. And it does. And it doesn't complain. And I think, haha, I can force. But of course, it's not entirely satisfying to just force something that doesn't have the ability to say no. There's only so much satisfaction one gets from forcing something that can't say no. So we also try to force somebody that can say no. And all of our competition, and yes, all of our wars, is all of our little fighting and big fighting, is all of us trying to force something, someone else who has the ability to say no. What we're trying to do is take someone who has the ability to say no and take away that ability from them.
Exactly.
We are trying to deprive others of their very right to exist. And of course, that's shown in an ultimate way by killing the body. Because we think we are the body. And we think if I kill the body, I've taken away that living being's right to exist. And we do that on a more subtle level. And we do that with various... We do that with various types of compulsions and various types of shoulds in our many relationships. You know, we say to the person we're married to or to our children, you should do this, you must do this, you have to do this. When we were going into the meeting yesterday, one gentleman who was going to give a presentation gave me some papers and said, oh, your friends who went in there didn't take them, give it to them and tell them they have to read it. And I said, am I supposed to put a gun to their head? He said, no, but you told them they have to read it. And if you'll notice that in a lot of our interchange with each other, we speak in these sort of terms. Have to, should, must, required. At Thomas A. Kempis, who was a monk in the 13th century, wrote a wonderful book called Imitation of Christ. And he said that we often want others to be compelled to do our will, although we want freedom in everything. You know, none of us want to do something out of a feeling of being forced.
But how many religions and how many churches force their will on the people?
Well, actually, it was interesting because it is actually impossible to force another living being. It is impossible. You can't do it. Krishna has designed us so that it is impossible for anybody to take away our free will. Because as soon as you take away our free will, we would cease to be alive.
Right.
It's only, they can't. It's only something material that has no free will. So free will cannot be taken. Even there's one place where Prabhupada said, Krishna cannot take away our free will. Because if he took our free will, we wouldn't be who we are. It's a meaningless statement. And Prabhupada made the point that because we're part of Krishna, mamayam so jivaloke jivabhutasanatana, that if Krishna were to take away our free will, he'd be taking away part of his own will, part of his own existence.
Look at how many Indians.
So that, can you wait till the end? Is that all right? Thanks. But you really helped me. Thank you. And I appreciate that. But right now you can help me by just waiting. Is that all right? Thank you. But you actually can't do that. And that's why when we try to force, and we're trying to force everything, we're trying to force matter, even we can't fully force matter, can we? Any of you have a computer? Can you always make it do what you want? No. Or your car? Right? Even our machines, they don't always do what we want them to do. What to speak of the planet? We're trying to force the planet to give resources in a particular way, trying to force the machines. What to speak of when we're trying to force another living being? We try to force another living being because we cannot take away their free will. We become very frustrated. Become very frustrated. We become very angry, and often then we try to accelerate or expand the means that we're using to try to force. We may do it in language. I've noticed there's a certain kind of language that's forcing language. Usually it's in very emotional words or strong adjectives or very or some kind of inflammatory language where we're trying to force the sort of response that we want to from others. Or I was giving some counseling to a married couple, and one time the woman went in to see her husband, and she said, if you won't change the baby's diaper, I'm just going to leave the baby here and go to the temple without you. And she drops the baby off in the room. And he takes the baby and takes him to the car and puts him in the car seat and says, sorry, not going to do it. And I talked to him about it, and I said, what's going on? He said, well, my wife comes and said that kind of thing. You know, if you don't change the baby's diaper, I'm going to just leave her here and go to the temple without her, him, or whoever was, you know. He said, I feel very afraid, because I'm afraid if I do what you say, I've lost my freedom. I've lost my autonomy. I've allowed you to force me. And if I don't do what you say, I'll lose you. I'll lose my relationship with you, and I don't know what to do. And they start having a power play. Who can force the other person more? Who can impose their will on the other? And these things eventually escalate into physical wars. And it's a fact that all these other things, greed, it's again, I'm trying to force my own will. I want something that's not been given to me. I'm going to take it by force. Or envy. Again, I'm trying to force something that's not mine. It's not my quota. Lust is also like that. I want some enjoyment that's not coming to me automatically by nature, and I want to grab it at any means. And hatred. We feel intense hatred when I'm not able to manipulate matter, or I'm not able to manipulate another person the way I want to. You know, that person hurt me, they damaged me, they said something, they did something, and I couldn't fix it. That person was recently talking to me and saying, you know, somebody's saying these nasty things about me that aren't true. How am I going to get them to believe I'm a nice person? I said, I don't know if you can force them to believe you're a nice person. I have papers here that show what a nice person I am. Yeah, why are we laughing? This all happened to all of us, right? I've got all these friends who are going to certify. Urmila's really a nice person. And I go to the person who doesn't think I'm a nice person. Please read this. It says how nice I am. I don't want to read it. No, read it. Like me. Be nice to me. We can't. We can't make someone else treat us even with decent respect. And the woman who just left, she was talking about being treated humanely. We can't do that. And then we become hateful. Or are you talking about meat eating? Meat eating is certainly a very extreme example of trying to force our will on another living being to the point that we take their life and subsume their body into ours. It's an extreme example of this desire to try to take away the free will and the life of another being. Now, all of these attempts at force, Prabhupada talks about the difference between love and rape, is an attempt at yoga. We're trying to find yoga. We're trying to find union. We're trying to find oneness, really. Love has to have two things simultaneously: complete oneness and complete separateness. And we have some, you know, imitations of this. Sex, of course, is an imitation of this, where we try to have total oneness yet total difference. Or a parenthood, the parent and child, probably especially the mother and child, where there's a kind of oneness, but yet there's two separate persons, or very good friends. You know, you have a friend where you just know what they're thinking, they know what you're thinking. You say, let's go, Anne. Go to the beach. Yes, how did you know? Right? You're just on the same wavelength. You just say one word, and they understand you, but yet you're two different people. I mean, nobody would have that much fun just talking in the mirror. You know? Being able to finish your own sentences talking in the mirror isn't exciting at all. Or we have this in groups too, people at sporting events, where we're all individuals, but we're all cheering for the same team. And this thing goes, you know, this thing is also with war, whether it's fought under the banner of religion or ethnicity or nationality. You know, we're a team. We're a group. We have some sort of unity. And it's true even with eating. I'm trying to have some unity with the thing that I'm eating. So we're looking for some place where we can be fully one and yet keep our individuality. And we do that materially through force. We're trying to do it through force. If not outright force, through obligation or through some sort of a business deal. You know, I'll give you this sense enjoyment and you give me that sense enjoyment. I'll give you this salary, you give me this work for the company. Some sort of a deal where we want the other person to feel obligated. We want them to feel obligated. In other words, we want them to have some sense of force. And we're trying to manipulate. So this is the essence of the difference between material life and spiritual life. Material life means that I want everyone to be, I want to be God, but I don't want to be God the way God is God. I want to be God as like a Hitler. You know, I want to force others, or I want to subtly obligate them, or I want to have some sort of business deal with them. I want something where I can think that this other being or this object is going to do my will. That really I will be the only one with will, and everything else will be an extension of me. That the planet, the objects, and other people. And of course, everybody has that same mentality. So just imagine, you know, here we are in a world where everyone has more or less that same mentality. Of course, there's going to be conflict. How can there not be? Right? And the spiritual world, everything is on the basis of freedom. Nobody ever tries to force anybody ever to do anything. Ever. There's no, as I said, there's no moral codes, there's no law, there's no feeling of obligation, there's no feeling of should. There's never this sort of thing like right now in this world, you know, we may think, oh, I don't really want to go. I don't really want to go to the class, but, you know, they expect me to. I'm living here, and, you know, they're not going to give me a place to stay and something to eat if I don't go. Maybe I'll just, you know, so there's, that doesn't exist in the spiritual world. The gopis are not thinking, oh, I don't want to dance with Krishna tonight. You know, I'd rather watch television. But, you know, if I don't go, then they'll throw me out of the spiritual world, so I guess I better show up. There's none of that. There's no feeling like that. Oh, I don't want to give Krishna my flowers. No, no, no. He's God. I got to do it anyway. It's not like that. You know, Mother Yasoda's coming to the tree. Now, you give those flowers now. There's no guilt. There's no obligation. There's no force. So how are we going to, and therefore there's perfect peace. There's perfect harmony. There's certainly rivalry and excitement. It's not all just like, oh, it's not boring. But because there's no force, there's perfect peace. And even in this world, we find if we can have relationships on the basis of freedom, we find great happiness and peace. Now, will we get to a point in the world where we eliminate all war? And as Prasad Prabhu pointed out, that in this world there will always be some war. There will always be some war. There will always be some conflict. Of course, there are times in the creation where that's minimal. In Satyayuga, for example, the amount of conflict is minimal because most people are functioning on this platform of freedom and respect. Most people, if they're not seeking to meet their needs by forcing other people or by forcing objects. Why? Because all of their needs are met internally, spiritually. Therefore, Krishna says, when you achieve that, you think there's no greater gain. And he's talking about a very beginning level of spiritual realization. Krishna says, if you just have a beginning level of spiritual realization, you don't think I need something else. You don't, and Krishna also says that such a person has no need to depend on any other living being. If my needs are met with Krishna, why would I need to force anything or anybody? I have everything I need. If I have everything that I need, if I'm fully fulfilled, I don't need to try to impose my will on matter or on anybody else. So if you have a society of people who are like that, even not at a fully realized level, but even a beginning level, then you have peace. Then you don't have war. You might say, well, I can't control that either. I can't make sure that every member in my household is functioning at that level of spiritual realization. I can't force others to be spiritually realized either. Sometimes we do that. We're talking about religion tries to force. And we see that sometimes. Be religious. That's a very low level. Or be spiritually advanced. It doesn't work. I can't force anyone else to become spiritually advanced. I was talking with one devotee. We were saying, you know, you can't force someone else to look in their heart and deal with their contaminations. I can put up a mirror to you. You know, here's a mirror. Why don't you look at it and see what you need to change? And you can look away. Or you can smash the mirror over my head. Right? So I can't do that with anybody else. I can't say I'm going to have everyone in my family be a transcendentally realized person and then we'll have a peaceful atmosphere. Or I'm going to have everyone who lives in the temple come to such a level of spiritual maturity that there's no quarrel and difficulty. And I've seen many people try to do that. But you can try to inspire people. You can set a good example. But ultimately, everybody has to make the decision to come to that place themselves. So what can we do?
George Harrison said, when we finally see beyond ourselves, we will find peace of mind is waiting there for us.
Okay, yes, thank you. Our good George Harrison. So how do we come to a place where there's peace? If I'm not going to be able to make everyone in the world function at that level of advanced consciousness. There are some times in the creation where that's the case. And maybe that'll be the case in this Kali Yuga. There's some predictions like that, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement will spread so that, again, we have a brief time of such a yuga. And I know that you don't experience this in Hawaii, so those of you who stay here for a long time don't even know what I'm talking about. But in places in the world where there's genuine winters, sometimes there's some nice days even in the middle of the winter. Sometimes, you know, a place where there's snow and everything, you can go out in short sleeves for a few days. So even in this present age of Quo, when we were talking about how the age is an age of Quo, there is a prediction that there's going to be a little window where it's like such a yuga. But even if that's not happening, and even if we're not going to experience that in this lifetime, how is it that we can be free from war? As soon as we give up the desire to force others, anyone, ever, as soon as we allow all living entities to have what they already have and that nobody will ever take away, not even Krishna, their complete freedom, and when we seek our satisfaction in our relationship with Krishna rather than trying to force matter or other living beings, then we're at peace. And then if someone else is trying to force us or exploit us, it doesn't affect us. And even if you're in the middle of a battle, this was Krishna's teaching to Arjuna, you may be in the middle of a battle, of a literal battle, where people were literally trying to dismember and kill each other. But you will be at peace. You won't really be in the war. And you won't really be killing anybody. He said, yeah, that's an illusion. You'll be in a state of peace. So that is the way to have peace. And of course, if enough of us do that, then there is a change also in our environment. And it doesn't actually take everybody. It really doesn't take everybody. There's a tipping point. So that is the mission of our International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That if we could get at least 1% of the population to come to this state of full freedom and full love of Krishna in the heart, then just that would start to change the atmosphere in the world. Whether it would solve all the problems of the world, that's doubtful. But would it make a significant difference? Yes, definitely. And we see, of course, that this is true on a material level. Just a few people can change the culture of the world. Happens all the time. We see that in a negative way, those of us who've been to India, we see how the culture has changed and become more degraded just over the last 30, 40 years. Just by the influence of the 100 people who run the television stations. It's only about 100 people who ultimately control the media. And those 100 people are changing the culture of the world. So why not? We shouldn't think that it's impossible. But whether or not that happens, we can certainly change ourselves. So you've contributed a lot, sir, and I'd like to ask if there's anybody else who has questions or comments or And I want to thank you for changing me. I was going to go in another direction, and I like the direction you took me for something. Yes.
You're talking about enforcing or taking away other people's freedom. I guess in a very practical way. So as a parent,
good question.
What is like the line of consequence and taking away their freedom?
Well, obviously, if you're dealing with an animal or a very small child who doesn't have the intelligence to exercise their will in a way that will be beneficial for themselves and others, you have to provide some physical direction. You don't just let a 1 or 2 year old child wander in the street in front of a car or give them a knife. But it's always with the mood that I'm serving this living being, not that I'm trying to force them or take away their will. It's a particular mindset that I respect that this living being has freedom of choice, but it's my responsibility to guide them. And as they grow older, then that, you know, physical thing gets less and less. So, you know, at this age, you may actually pick them up and move them someplace. Does that make sense?
I think I have a pretty good idea. The little one, but I'm a teenager.
Well, Prabhupada says you can. Prabhupada says you can. You can influence a child until they're 16. At 16, the person is at a point of consciousness where your only influence over them is what you have over another adult. Until 16, you do have the ability to influence and mold the child to some extent against their will. And Krishna has arranged for human beings alone among all of the species to have a very long childhood where the child is very vulnerable to being trained in a particular way. And this is not, even on the higher planets, the demigods don't have this. So Krishna has arranged this for us to train the child in proper use of the freedom. But it should always be done with respect. The time when you find that parents get very frustrated dealing with their children is, again, when they're trying to force their will upon the child. If you analyze it, what is my mood? Is my mood of training to help the child come to a point where when they reach full freedom at 16, they can use it properly? Or is my mood to try to force them to do my will and be an extension of me? And pretty much, we know, when parents get really frustrated and really angry, which I think almost all parents do from time to time, if you think about it, it's usually this idea that why won't the child just do why won't they just do what I want them to do? It's more of an attitude of respect. Does that make sense? I mean, obviously at this age, you just pick them up and move them. But even then, it's with an attitude of respect. So they always keep in mind that, you know, I'm dealing with another living being. Even when I'm dealing with matter, even when I'm dealing with a cup, this cup being Krishna's energy is in one sense non-different from Krishna. Therefore, even when I'm moving the material energy, how should I even move the material energy? Always with the what of Krishna? Permission. Krishna. Actually, one should always be offering everything to Krishna, even matter. Even matter, I don't think I'm a manipulator of matter. So although I can take the cup and put it here, and I can put it here, they try to do everything in a way, because ultimately it's Krishna. That's respecting him. It's mostly an attitude with the children, that you are a living being and you do have free will. I remember once I was dealing with one student, she was about 13, and she wanted to do something. And I said, look, right now you're in my school, and this is the school rules. I know you don't agree with it. I said, but as long as you're in the school, I have to ask you to follow this rule. I said, you know, look, you'll be 18 one day, and then if you don't want to follow that rule in your own home, you can do what you want. So right now I'm asking you to respect that this is how we do things here. And her mother was staying there listening, and she said, don't tell her that. I said, first of all, she already knows that. I said, second of all, that puts the whole conversation on the platform of respect. That I'm saying to you, look, I know you don't like this, I know this is not what you prefer to do, but in this particular circumstance, I need your cooperation in order for things to go on. And you have a choice to cooperate or not, but if you choose not to cooperate, then I'm going to have to ask you to leave, because I also have a choice about how I want things to be run. So that when you get in that place, you end up dealing with people quite differently. And Prabhupada certainly told us when dealing with devotees, he said, be careful not to destroy the spirit of enthusiastic service, which is individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. So always remember that everyone is doing, you know, they're doing things voluntarily. And that's important even with children. You know, once the child is about 13 months old, they start manifesting the fact that they're a free-willed being. So we've got 1 minute. Anybody else? Thank you very much. Now we have the RT ceremony, and thank you very much for taking me that place. I hope you all were happy with that.
Very nice.
Are you happy with that? I know you're happy with that.
Right.
Bessie, were you happy with that? Was that interesting? A little different than what I had planned. Thank you very much. All glories to Shri Prabhupada.